Hello, welcome to an episode of Little Fish. But before we go anywhere, Andy, there is something quite important that we have to say.
Yes, we're going to be doing a live show. We're going to be going to Sweden to the Lund Comedy Festival in August.
Yes, the 29th of August at 7 p.m. Anna will be there too. I know. Exciting, eh?
Oh my God.
I'm even surprised she's still here. She's not been in touch with me for the last 9 months. But if you would like to get involved in the pre-sale, that is for people who are members of Club Fish. So you need to go to patreon.com/clubfish and find out more about it there.
That's right. General sale opens at the end of the week, but you can access the ticket pre-sale now, as James says, if you join Club Fish at patreon.com/clubfish.
Okay, on with the podcast.
On with the show. Hello and welcome to another episode of Little Fish. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray and I'm here with Dan Schreiber and James Harkin, and we are going to go through your facts from the last 7 days. Your facts have been flooding into the Fish inbox, podcast@qi.com, and now we're going to tell you some of the best ones. Who's got a fact?
Okay, I've got one. This is from Henry Bix. Henry says that in 2016, a Gothenburg man apologized for removing a giant snow penis by replacing it with a much larger snow penis, and this has led to a spin-off tradition and even a new political party.
Oh,
okay. Some questions.
So many questions.
Is that a sincere apology, replacing a penis with a much larger snow penis?
Yeah, because he was apologizing for removing the original one.
Right.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Next question.
The man in the beanie hat.
Thank you. The penis, just a bit more on that, please. Is it a vertical standing with two testes, or what are we talking?
Okay, so the original was a flat drawing. It was done on a river in Gothenburg, and the government couldn't remove it until the weather changed because the ice was too thin. And then a local company helped out by getting a giant brush that they used to clean windows on tall buildings, and they brushed it out. Now, people on the internet then got really, really mad because they thought that the government had been spending taxpayers' dollars rubbing out this penis, and they, you know, set up Facebook pages saying this is disgusting. And the man who did it, who wasn't from the government, he was just doing what he thought was a good deed, then said, okay, fine. And he went into the north of the country, got a couple of massive snowblowers, and then drew an enormous penis on the ground, which was 70 meters in length. And the tradition, the new tradition, these are 3D penises, which are on a roundabout in a place called Buros.
Okay.
I think it's a good use of taxpayers' money to get rid of an enormous penis that someone's drawn on the ground. Call me Captain Government.
But, you know, there isn't a magical money tree, Andy. Who's not getting
the
money?
I think that's one of the core functions of a government, if I'm honest. It's like defence, absolutely, comes first. Yeah. Second, remove snow penises. Third, ensure prosperity. Those are my two top priorities. And that's my political party.
Yeah.
Why is there a political party?
The political party is the people who have started doing this tradition in the town of Buros. The political thing, you know, they do put up these penises, but actually they're kind of an art collective, and they started a political party to see how easy it would be to set up a political party.
Oh, I see.
It's like an art thing, but then part of the art thing is also making these giant sculptures. I should say that the information that I got all of this additional stuff from is a YouTuber called Edlund Art, who did an amazing video about it.
Very nice. Cool.
Very nice.
There's a drawing of a penis on the moon as well. Which
blow it up.
Is
blow it up.
I think it's big enough already, Andy. I don't think you need to blow it up.
This was the Moon Museum. I'm sure you guys have heard of it. So it was left up there by Apollo 12, and it was a group of artists. So there was David Novoros, John Chamberlain, but Andy Warhol was one of them. And it's this tiny little, it looks like almost like a chip that you would put into a camera. And it's got little bits of art on it. And Andy Warhol drew a penis. And I think at the time he justified saying that it was a W and an A. And if you're being very generous, it kind of does look like that. But really, it's a cock and balls drawing.
Okay. Well, that will be useful if the aliens come. they will know what to expect when they arrive in Sweden.
Let's have another, Dan.
Okay, here's one from Magnus Silverwood. Magnus writes, "My fact is that Jupiter is not mostly composed of gas, but is in fact largely liquid hydrogen covered by gas clouds." And what Magnus finds really interesting about this, which is unbelievably fascinating because of the coincidence, is how we found this out. 1995, the spacecraft Galileo entered the orbit of Jupiter for the first time, just in time to witness what has been estimated as a 1 in 6,000 year event, the collision of the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9, as it crashed into the surface of Jupiter. So the collision threw up a lot of debris into the atmosphere, the composition of which was studied, and they also opened a small observation window beneath the clouds so that they could see what was going on down there as the smoke was coming up. Yeah, and they found out that it's not
the case. They found an enormous image of a penis.
Oh God, they've got their own tiresome art collectives on Jupiter, have they?
But as
that's
a result
that's
of this,
incredible. That is incredible.
Yeah, they got to see this extraordinary thing that 1 in 6,000, and that's the story of how we discovered that. And Galileo, that mission itself was a very interesting mission because they confirmed for the first time that there is life on Earth. And right. That was, as Galileo was flying away from us, Carl Sagan, who was part of the project, asked for it to be turned around and have all the instruments face Earth and take a reading. And the reading it took showed signs of life on our planet. And that might sound silly, but it served a major scientific purpose. It showed us what you would be looking for if you were looking for life on a planet. It could measure oxygen and methane in Earth's atmosphere. It spotted a steep cliff in the infrared spectrum of sunlight reflecting off the planet, and it had this red edge to it, which indicated the presence of vegetation. It picked up radio transmissions that were coming from the surface to show that there must be an intelligent life that were manufacturing artificial sounds and so on. So,
what year was it, Doug?
1995 was the mission. Yeah.
I was just thinking what radio they might... They'd have got the Archers.
Yes. They would have got Scatman John, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, if they were listening to the right music channel. Boom, 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 let me hear say whale. That would have been in the air. Not the best musical moment to be discovering Earth, but...
here's one. This came in from Karen Gupta. So thank you very much, Karen. It's that the Indian Republic Day Parade held in New Delhi features 1,270 kilos of boneless chicken. Riddle me this.
Well, there's lots of people there and they need to eat.
It's not for people. It's not. These 1,200 kilos of boneless chicken are not for people.
Did they put it on the side of the town so that all of the wild animals go out to eat the chicken and they don't get in the way of the parade?
Very good. You've got it.
Oh, nice.
You've got it. The chicken is spread out, says Karen, at specific locations to attract black kites and prevent bird strikes because there are a load of planes that do the parade.
Oh.
And there are also a load of black kites in Delhi and they fly at roughly the height that they might go into one of the engines and ruin their ruin everyone's day and ruin an otherwise happy parade. And so... they have been putting out lots and lots of meat. They used to do buffalo, but they've recently changed the recipe to chicken.
Can I ask, are these kites really picky eaters that they don't like to eat chicken with bones in it?
What a good point. I don't know. I think I did look it up a bit, and it has to be in pieces of a specific size.
It's interesting, because I would have thought that they would just eat animals normally, right? They would eat like little voles or something. And they have bones in them.
Yeah, you're right. I think it's... I don't know what the reason is. I guess they can't just say, we'll just throw up any old shite for them. Because this is the... you know, it's a big Republic Day parade. It's got to be... every element of it has to be meticulously planned.
And also, like, you need to put something really nice for the kites. You can't just put, like, some chicken thighs out there because they'll be like, oh, yeah, we could get that anywhere.
No.
Oh, but look, it's the amazing boneless stuff we can
boneless.
Get in there.
Jerk rubbed. I don't know what I'm trying to come up with a chicken recipe. I don't eat much chicken. But I think it's quite meaningful that it's chickens because, of course, they can't fly. And yet they, with their sacrifice, are allowing the aerial parade to happen. So in a sense, they can.
I think chickens can fly a little bit, can't they?
Come on. Not much.
Not much, but they can, like, you know...
If you throw them in the air, they will flap as they fall.
I believe that if you have chickens and you have a building like a shed and it's like 2 meters tall, they can get onto it, I reckon.
Really?
I think so.
Yeah, I think that's right.
They can sort of flutter upwards.
Yeah, they can. They're. I mean, not flyers.
Like not the ones that like Bernard Matthews has fed to within an inch of their life. Like those guys can't do much.
No. Very interesting. Okay. Yeah. What's the highest you've ever seen a chicken fly? Podcast at qi.com. Why do I do it to myself?
Okay. Here is a fact from Jennifer Neal. And Jennifer writes about a species of fungi found in the fungarium at Kew Gardens. Ooh. That does not grow naturally anywhere else in the world.
Cool.
Riddle me this.
Okay.
I love our little mystical riddles. It doesn't grow, it shrinks.
Ah,
it's born
yes.
at a full size and then shrinks over the course of its life. Easy.
Like there is a paradoxical, is it a paradoxical
Paradoxical
fish
frog.
Frog, that's it, that's born bigger than it grows more... as an adult.
it's
like the female gives birth to this enormous tadpole and then when it turns into a frog, it gets smaller.
Must be irritating for the mum.
This is a clue. This fungus is called Golfbalia ambusta.
Ah.
The reason that it doesn't grow anywhere is because it is an actual golf ball. It's a golf ball that has been burnt, and it was sent to Kew Gardens in 1952 from Lancashire as a joke. I think actually, like, to be honest, it's not certain whether the people who found it thought it was a joke or whether they thought it was an actual fungus. But definitely the guy who took it in was called R.W.G. Dennis, who is the head of mycology at the Royal Botanic Gardens. And certainly he was in on a joke of giving it an official name and
it's
describing
pretty
funny
it.
Joke. Yeah, he's a fun guy. He described it.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Sorry, I couldn't help that. I'm really sorry.
I walked into it.
I feel like I would have to hand back my comedy gun and badge if I didn't make that joke.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But he described it in an official paper as small, hard, but elastic spheres enjoyed by the Caledonians in certain tribal rites. And he was, one, making a joke, but two, kind of making a point that there was no definition of what a mushroom was at that time. And some mycologists, so people who've studied mushrooms, said that a fungus should be anything that's studied by mycologists. As in, if we study it, it's just automatically a fungus, because it was so hard to define. And he said, well, you can't really do that, because if you do that, then I'm going to call this golf ball a fungus. What I'm really interested in is that it was sent from Lancashire, and I have played most golf courses in Lancashire, I would say, but I can't for the life of me find out which golf course it's from, this ball. And I'm just really excited to find out. That's what I'm really interested in.
Yeah.
Feels like you missed the point of the whole story. Yeah.
I got another one here. This is from Brian Simpson. The band The Postal Service was sent a cease and desist letter from the United States Postal Service, but were then allowed to keep the name after agreeing to perform for the USPS. I actually used to listen to this band. They had one album. It was a sort of super group. The lead singer was from the band Death Cab for Cutie. And the reason that they were called the Postal Service is because that's how the album was created. One of them would put a bed of music down, put it in the post.
One of them would write a note. E sharp. Is there an E sharp? No, there's not. Bollocks.
Of all the notes you could have gone for.
God damn it. F sharp. He'd wait for a return of post. Is that how they did it? Yeah.
That's exactly how they did. Have you been reading the notes? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So they just had conflicting schedules. So they sent it to each other through the post. It was slightly annoying when it was revealed that they didn't, in fact, use the US Postal Service as their method of posting, but used others like FedEx and the United Parcel Service. So they got sent this cease and desist letter. They went and met up with them, and they agreed that if they would play at their National Executive Conference in Washington, D.C., then they would be allowed to use the name. They struck up a good relationship then. The band CDs were then sold on the USPS official website.
Wow.
So they got a lot of publicity off the back of this moment. So yeah, the lead singer is married to Zooey Deschanel. There's a little bonus fact there. The reason his band's called Death Cab for Cutie is that it was a song by the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, and it was performed in Magical Mystery Tour, the Beatles film. Always comes back to the Beatles.
Yeah.
It Bonzo certainly Dog. Does when you're talking, Dan.
I got one.
Yeah, go on.
This is from Nick Size. I thought you might find it interesting, he writes, that the French learned how to make the nuclear bomb by playing 20 questions with American scientists.
No.
Way. So basically, America's got the nuclear bomb. France doesn't. Yeah. American law forbids America from sharing nuclear secrets. But they're both allies. I think this is after NATO is set up. So America wants France to have the bomb. But legally, they can't say, this is how you make a nuclear bomb. So instead, they use this system called negative guidance, where the French would say, here's what we're doing. And the Americans would say, hotter, colder, oh, don't do that. And basically, they just sort of reverse guided them to having a nuclear bomb. Isn't that crazy?
And you can do that in 20 questions?
Doesn't seem likely.
Exactly. That's no more than 20, yeah.
Because, like, you use the first one up with, like, animal, vegetable, or mineral, right?
Yeah.
So, like, that's only 19 after that.
Yeah, but you know the mineral, which is uranium. So, you're laughing.
It feels like they probably had the plans, but they had to go through the diplomatic process of asking 20 questions.
Don't get hung up on the 20 thing. I think they were probably allowed a few extensions to the 20.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think so.
Like 20,000.
France got to the end of the 20 questions and the Americans were like, oh, well, that's a shame.
Sorry.
I guess the West's nuclear umbrella will just have to have a little panel missing, won't it? Oh, well.
Okay, here is one last one from me. This is from Matt Souza. And Matt Souza writes that my significant other, this is Matt's significant other, is a veterinary technician who just informed me of a fact you all might enjoy. There exist online courses to become a certified rat tickler. This is amazing. There's basically tickling rats is a very important thing in science because the pathways in rats' brains are very similar to the pathways in humans' brains, especially when you're being tickled. Huh. And so whenever they want to do any tickle science, then they do it on rats first. And rats absolutely love it. And they're, you know, if you're a rat tickler, you only need to walk into a room and all the rats are going to jump around going, oh my God, the rat tickler's here. We can't wait to be tickled.
That's James, cool. Are you about to tell us that you have completed this course and become a certified rat tickler? Because I'll be so happy if you have.
I only wish that I thought of it. No, I think it probably takes a bit longer than we had in the day and a half since you said these facts over. I feel like...
How hard could it be to tickle a rat? Sounds like they're up for a tickle.
Yeah, we all of us should have. You know how people who chase meteorites, they get a report that one's landed and they just have to go immediately to go and find it. They all have a bag ready at the door for these moments. I think we need the equivalent where it's like rat tickling course available. We're recording tomorrow. See you, honey. Yep. Out the door.
Sorry, yep. Polina. The harking signal is in the sky. The rat ticklers need me.
Right. That is enough of your facts. Let's have some facts being dished out to you. Because if you join Club Fish, which is our members club on Patreon, at the highest tier, which is Friend of the Podcast, then you will get a shout out on the show and we will allocate you a fact and send you a certificate confirming that you are forever the custodian of this fact. So we're going to do a bunch of those now. If you want to check it out, go to patreon.com/clubfish. You can join at any of the tiers and there's great stuff on all of them, frankly. But let's have some custodians. Who wants to go first?
I will. Okay, this one is now under the custodianship of Melinda Fredrickson. Melinda, your fact is that in Kentucky, In March 1876, it rained mutton-tasting meat.
Lovely.
I think what happened was it was fed to a load of black kites and they went out like, what's this disgusting stuff? And just spat it out over this time. No, I don't remember. I think basically what happened was this so-called mutton-tasting meat fell down to earth and we still don't know what it was. And it could be that some frogs were sort of sucked up in a water spout and then flown over sort of Wizard of Oz style and then landed in this place in Kentucky. And then people ate the frog and thought, oh, this tastes a bit like mutton. Or it could have been something else. We don't really know what it was.
No, you're right. We'll never know. But I do love it. I love the fact.
Yeah.
I'll do another fact now. This goes out now to Grapefruit Street. Congratulations, Grapefruit Street. This is your fact. It is that Victorian inventor Peter Halkett invented a coat which doubled up as a boat.
Yes. Love this.
I remember this.
And
yeah.
it could take eight people. He could fit eight people in his boat coat.
It's amazing. It's like a modern day Noah, you know?
Yeah.
Yes.
And if it's eight people, I think you can fit Mrs. Noah and
Ham,
Shem, and Japheth.
Yeah. Right.
Someone dropped out before the third Noah child, James.
Yeah.
Where were you in Sunday school? and three of their friends. So they can all bring their girlfriends or their wives if they like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shame about the animals, but I'm sure some of them can swim. And see you later, everybody. It was a boat all the time, not just a coat. Eat it. Oh, happy days. Here's another one. This one goes out to Hayden Freeman. Congratulations, Hayden. Your fact forever is now that in 18th century France, tooth pullers were entertainers. One fired a gun while pulling teeth with his head in a bag. Fact about ancient dentistry.
Amazing.
Great. Yes, I remember that. I remember this fact. They had all sorts of wacky tricks. And
was it because we didn't have any of the anesthetic? So it was a sort of distraction?
I don't think it was for the patient's benefit. I'll say that much. I think it was to draw crowds.
They went from town to town, didn't they? And they would sort of turn up and say, I'm here. Who needs their tooth pulled out? And they'd also sell their kind of their balms and quack medicines and stuff.
Yeah.
So they're just trying to get people in, really. And also, you've got someone screaming because you haven't given them any anesthetic. You've got to distract the crowd somehow from that.
Yeah. Yes.
And you can do that by shooting a stranger on the other side of the crowd.
See, this guy isn't hurt as much as that guy.
Yeah. You could be worse off. Look at him.
Okay, here is another fact. This one is now under the custodianship of Adam Webb. And the fact is that in the First World War, the Romanian army issued an order saying that only officers above the rank of major had the right to wear eyeshadow in battle.
Very strict.
I think we kind of looked at the use of makeup in history in the army and for the fact that men used to wear makeup a lot more than women and all sorts of stuff like that.
Yeah. Actors used to wear green makeup in films. Am I making that up? Do you remember early days of Hollywood?
Black and white films. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's great. And that's why the Romanians who fought on...
Good question.
Which side?
I think they fought on our, because Hungary were not on our side, were they? So I assume that the Romanians who border Hungary probably were. Andy, you can Google it.
Romania joined the Allied powers.
Yeah.
They were on our side.
Yeah.
Very nice.
I've always liked them. Always liked those Romanians.
Here's another one. This one goes out to Molinol. Molinol, your fact is Daisy Meadows, the most borrowed children's author from British libraries, doesn't exist.
Ah, yeah.
What?
I myself had never actually heard of Daisy Meadows and still have not heard really of Daisy Meadows. if I think of all the books in my house or the books I see in bookshops, I don't spot Daisy Meadows, but she is a brand, basically. It's a group of authors that write underneath the name Daisy Meadows. Much in the same way that Tom Clancy novels are now ghostwritten under that name, or Virginia Andrews of Flowers in the Attic. It's that thing you can't let go. Once an author has nailed a genre, you just start writing using their name.
Yeah.
Michael Crichton is another example of that. So yeah, pretty amazing for someone who's the most borrowed yet least heard of all the big children's authors.
Very cool. Very fact. Cool. Here's another one. This goes out to Luke. Congratulations, Luke. It's the fact that it would cost $850 quadrillion to build a Death Star.
And that was built by your father, Luke, interestingly.
Really nice. Really nice.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. yeah, this is just a fact about budgets, I suppose. And
well, there was that thing where
Project overreach. You know, on time and under budget, dream on.
Well, there's this thing where you can, if you get a petition up on the White House website and enough people sign it, there has to be an official response. And this was one of those petitions that reached the required number to get the response, which was, can you build a Death Star? It would only cost 850 quadrillion. And someone had done the math.
But that's really good, because it's good that it happened under a previous administration. Because I think if someone pitched it now, might well go through.
I think you might be right. Okay, yeah. Here is another fact. This one is now under the custodianship of Meredith Baku. And Meredith, your fact is, it's a festive one. Before going on stage to read A Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens drank a pint of champagne mixed with 2 tablespoons of rum and sherry with raw eggs.
Lovely.
Now, there is a story behind this. This was a live show at the Aces and Eights that we did. And, well, Anna wasn't going to let Charles Dickens get away with being the only person to drink a pint of champagne before a show. And if you listen back to episode 41, you can almost pinpoint the exact moment that those bubbles hit Anna's head when she gets very drunk halfway through the show.
Yeah,
we ran out just before the show started and bought a couple of bottles, I think a Prosecco in the end, and poured a bunch of pints. I drank mine the whole way through the show because I couldn't do it. Anna absolutely downed it before we went on. And amazing fact about Dickens generally, though, that fact and his live shows that he used to do and how this is how he operated.
Right, let's have one more.
Yep, this goes out to James McDonald. Crap Christmas jumpers date back to the Romans.
So this, like, was this good. it was a live show, wasn't it? And it was our Christmas special.
Yeah.
And yeah, this was basically Marshall, who wrote back in the Roman times, and he wrote about, I think it was it Saturnalia, or it was one of those one of those festivals that they did, which we now say is kind of similar to a modern Christmas. And he said that one of the things they did would be they would give each other sort of quite garish clothing.
So good. I've never worn a Christmas jumper.
Have you not?
I'm sorry, what?
Why not? Is it now that you've gone this far, has it become a thing that you just refuse to?
No, I've never refused to. I've never been asked to. I've just never engaged with that whole scene. Wow. I've got a couple of fun jumpers, but they're not Christmassy. And when I say fun, I just mean they've got a slightly bolder knit than I'm happy with.
I suppose you do wear fun jumpers all the time. Like, we all call you Fun Jumper Andy. So, like, doing something special over Christmas doesn't really make sense for you.
Absolutely. I'm a fun jumper guy the other 364 days of the year. Right. That's enough of this stuff. Let's have one final round of thanks to our wonderful new fact custodians and friends of the podcast. They are James, Meredith, Luke, Molinol, Adam, Hayden, Grapefruit Street, and Melinda. So thank you so much to all of you. Thank you to all of you who are listening, who have joined Clubfish at any of the tiers. It makes a massive difference. If you would like to give that a go and get ad-free episodes and bonus content and much more besides, just go to patreon.com/clubfish. Until then, it's bye from all of us, and we'll see you in a few days' time for another Big Fish.